Imagine the sound of like crushed heavy minerals being dragged across a thick, bone-dry piece of cotton paper.
Oh, yeah, that physical, scraping, really tactile noise.
Exactly. There is a very real friction to it. Now contrast that sound with a silent, climate-controlled server farm humming in the dark, just hallucinating a human face out of thin air.
Right, two completely different worlds.
Yeah, and welcome to today's deep dive because we are looking at an artwork that somehow forces those two entirely different universes to collide.
It's a really jarring collision, too.
It totally is. For you listening, we're pulling from an artist's studio notes, a gallery press release, and some really fascinating critical essays to examine a piece by Jairo Duke.
Titled Homes and Faces 3.
Right. And the core mission of this deep dive is to explore this really fascinating contradiction. Like, how does an artwork derive such crushing physical and emotional weight when its subject matter was technically generated by a weightless, placeless digital algorithm?
It's the central tension of the whole piece, really.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the technical specs of this painting set up this profound debate between the tangible reality of the artist's studio and the completely ethereal nature of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and that collision between the digital and the physical, I
Yeah.
mean, it sits right at the foundation of the piece.
It's literally step one.
Exactly. To understand the friction in Homes and Faces the Third, you really have to start with its digital origin, because
Yeah.
the reference image for this watercolor, it isn't a photograph of a real person.
Right. Duke didn't just have a live model sitting in a chair in his studio.
No, not at all. He used an AI neural network to generate the initial concept.
Which instantly brings up a lot of questions for me. Because when we talk about themes of displacement or violence and the loss of a home, relying on a machine algorithm feels, I don't know, totally counterintuitive.
Feels very detached, right?
Yeah. We usually associate those themes with deep human empathy, not some sterile computer program.
It definitely seems cold on the surface, but looking at the critical essays surrounding the work, there's a very deliberate, highly analytical reason for this choice.
Okay, I'm listening.
So, think about how an AI actually builds an image. To really grasp it, you have to picture what developers call a latent space.
A latent space, like a digital map or something.
Yeah, imagine a massive multidimensional map inside the computer's memory. And on this map, the AI has plotted out millions and millions of human faces from all across the internet.
Oh, wow. So it's just scraping everything.
Right. So when you ask it to generate a new face, it doesn't just copy and paste one specific person. It finds a mathematical coordinate somewhere in the middle of all those
So
points.
it's actively blurring the lines.
Exactly. It averages those millions of faces together. It deliberately erases specific ethnicities.
And it removes any recognizable geographic markers, I assume.
You got it. So the face that the AI generates is this really weird paradox. Because it is a mathematical average of humanity, it is a face that belongs to absolutely everyone.
But because it has no specific real-world origin,
It belongs to absolutely no one.
it literally creates a person without a zip code.
What's fascinating here is the strategy behind using that specific kind of image for a piece about displacement.
Right, because normally you'd want to highlight a specific story.
Well, imagine a scenario where a US-based artist sitting in a secure, comfortable studio decides to paint a hyper-realistic portrait of a real specific family who was displaced by a real bombing abroad.
Oh, yeah, the power dynamic there gets very uncomfortable very quickly.
It borders on exploitative.
It would feel invasive, almost like turning a specific family's ongoing real-world tragedy into like an aesthetic spectacle just for an art gallery.
Exactly. It would cross a line into voyeurism. So the critical text argues that using an AI to generate a face without a homeland actually acts as a conceptual shield.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. By relying on a mathematically averaged face, the artist prevents the appropriation of specific localized pain. The digital neutrality protects real people from having their specific suffering colonized for the sake of art.
Okay, I hear the logic in that, and I completely understand the strategy of using the AI as a shield, but
Right.
I have to push back a little on the idea that digital neutrality is enough to carry an artwork. Like, if this piece just stayed inside that neural network, it would be nothing but a cold phantom.
A concept with no actual soul.
Exactly. What gives Homes and Faces Third its visceral power is how violently that weightless AI concept is dragged into the harsh physical reality of the artist's studio.
Specifically, his studio in Whittier, California.
Yes. Duke takes this sterile algorithm and forces it to fight against real-world materials. Like, the studio notes detail that this is painted on Arch's cotton paper.
Oh, and specifically the 640-gram weight, which is a huge detail.
It is a crucial detail for anyone who understands papermaking. For those of you who haven't handled it, 640-gram paper is essentially a thick, heavy slab of woven cotton.
It's practically cardboard.
Yeah, a single square meter of this stuff weighs well over a pound. It is rough. It has deep textures, microscopic peaks, and these really deep valleys.
It is designed to physically resist the brush.
Exactly. You can practically picture the artist in that California studio physically wrestling with this heavy, thirsty material, just trying to force the watercolor to do something structural.
And that translation, you know, from screen to paper, it completely shatters the illusion of the smooth digital face.
Right.
The heavy weight of that cotton paper entirely rejects the neutrality of the algorithm.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because that physical resistance completely dictates the visual composition.
It does. When you look at the gallery images of this piece, you do not see a smooth AI-generated face at all.
No, you see extreme cubist fragmentation.
Which is so striking.
Let's define what that actually looks like for a second, because it's not just blocky shapes. It looks like you are viewing the face through a shattered pane of thick glass.
The features are sliced up into these harsh geometric planes.
Yeah, every shard seems to reflect a slightly different angle of the person. And trying to achieve those sharp, shattered edges in a medium like watercolor is notoriously difficult.
Oh, absolutely. Because the fundamental nature of watercolor is movement. I mean, it wants to flow.
It does not want to stay put.
Right. If you put wet paint next to wet paint, the water basically acts as a bridge, and the pigments will immediately bleed and spread into each other across those cotton fibers.
Literally anyone who ever used a watercolor set in elementary school knows exactly what happens.
We've all been there.
You try to paint a blue sky next to a yellow sun, you rush it, and suddenly everything bleeds into a big, muddy, brown puddle on the page.
The worst.
Now, take that basic frustration and scale it up to the meticulous, agonizing studio process Duke is using here to get those razor-sharp, fragmented geometric planes.
To build this shattered face without it turning into mud.
Exactly. The artist has to impose extreme discipline. You paint one tiny jagged section of the face, then you have to put the brush down.
And just wait.
You have to wait for that section to completely dry. The water has to evaporate entirely before you can even think about painting the contiguous section right next to it.
It is a process of manual pigment resistance.
That's a great way to put it.
The artist is basically imposing strict, unyielding borders on a medium that naturally just wants to dissolve borders.
And the physical painting technique itself becomes a massive metaphor for the subject matter.
Oh, for sure. Think about the emotional reality of displacement or shared trauma.
Right. You have these fragments of a life or fragments of a community jammed up against each other, trying to share the same small space.
But they are completely isolated by these hard, dry boundaries.
Yes. The technique of waiting for the paint to dry to establish a hard border perfectly mimics that forced, compartmentalized coexistence.
The medium literally becomes the message. And that physical compartmentalization directly informs the expressions on these fragmented faces.
I noticed that. They don't look how you'd expect.
No, they don't. When analyzing the subjects in Holmes and Faces the Third, the critical essays point out that the restraint is actually the most jarring element.
What do you mean by restraint?
Well, think of classic historical depictions of war or suffering in art. In a piece like Picasso's Guernica, the agony is loud. You have heads thrown back, gaping mouths, bodies twisting in active torment.
Right. It's the chaotic, deafening moment of impact.
Exactly. But in Duke's watercolor, that immediate chaos is entirely absent. There are no tears. There are no screaming mouths.
The eyes don't even plead with the viewer.
The expressions are utterly ambiguous and severely contained within those dry watercolor borders. The analysis describes these faces less like traditional portraits and more like topography.
Topography, like a map.
Like collapsed buildings or architectural ruins.
The face becomes a landscape of rubble.
That's spot on. The artist isn't showing you the frantic moment the bomb drops or the panic day the home is lost. He is showing you the years that follow.
The aftermath.
Right. This represents a fossilized chronic suffering. It is a pain that has been endured for so long that it has kind of exhausted itself. It no longer has the energy to scream.
It has simply become the structure of everyday life.
I view it as a geometry of survival. The harsh lines aren't just an aesthetic choice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They are the rigid scaffolding required to just keep standing after a total collapse.
A geometry of survival. Wow, that completely reframes those harsh cubist lines. They are essentially holding the shattered pieces together.
Yeah.
But, you know, if the faces are acting as a metaphor for ruined architecture, it makes me look for the literal architecture in the piece.
Sure, given the title.
Right, the title is Homes and Faces Third. We've dissected the faces, but where are the actual homes in this composition?
Well, finding the homes requires you to examine the physical weight of the color, which actually circles back to the materials chosen in that Whittier studio.
The palette is really striking.
The palette itself tells the story of the architecture.
The color choices are incredibly severe. Like, the vast majority of the paper is dominated by these oppressive, cold grays and deep, muted blues.
Feels like the color of mourning, honestly.
Yeah.
Or wet concrete.
Yes, wet concrete. But then that coldness is violently interrupted by these sudden, aggressive flashes of warm yellows and deep reds.
And those red flashes, they are not achieved with a standard dye. The studio notes specify the use of Daniel Smith watercolors.
Okay, what's special about those?
These paints are highly regarded for a specific physical characteristic called granulation. It involves using crushed, heavy mineral pigments rather than, like, synthetic liquid dyes.
Which means we are dealing with actual microscopic rocks suspended in water.
Exactly. So when the artist lays that brush down on the paper, the water starts to evaporate. But those heavy minerals don't just fade away evenly.
Right, they have physical weight.
They physically drop out of the suspension. They sink into the deep, microscopic valleys of that rough 640-gram cotton paper. They pool and settle really irregularly in the crevices.
The pigment interacts with the texture of the cotton to create this actual physical buildup.
Yeah, it's very tactile.
So when you look at a streak of red pigment on this paper, it is not a smooth digital red filter applied to a screen. The heavy minerals create a dense, tactile texture that looks remarkably like a scab.
It really does.
It looks like a physical, badly healed wound on the paper itself. The artist is achieving this lasting psychological weight through the literal physical interaction of heavy stones and thick cotton.
An AI algorithm could never replicate that physical abrasion.
Never. You can almost feel the texture of the trauma just by looking at the grain of the paint.
The trauma becomes a tangible object you could theoretically run your hand over, but to address your search for the actual homes.
Right, where are they?
This is where the artwork demands a significant cognitive effort from the audience. The homes in the painting are almost entirely indecipherable.
I noticed that. You really have to scan the edges and squint to find anything even resembling a building.
They are dissolved into the margins. They exist merely as latent background structures, totally obscured behind and around the shattered geometry of the faces.
They are pushed completely out of focus.
Yeah.
Doesn't hiding the main subject run the risk of alienating the viewer, though? Like, it makes the piece incredibly dense and frustrating to read.
It's definitely a challenging piece.
If the primary theme of the painting is the destruction and loss of the home, why not just paint a clearly destroyed home so the viewer immediately grasps the tragedy?
Well, think about it. Providing a clear, easy-to-read illustration of a destroyed house allows the viewer to consume the sadness quickly, glance at it, and just walk away feeling satisfied that they understood the point.
Oh, I see. It makes it too easy.
Right. Hiding the home is a deliberate psychological tactic. The artist forces you into a slow, frustrating visual search.
By making your eyes hunt for structural order within all that geometric chaos?
Exactly. The artwork forces your brain to simulate a specific cognitive state.
Wait, it's simulating the actual feeling of displacement.
Yes. It creates a sense of profound disorientation.
Hmm.
When a person loses their home, the physical structure is gone, but the mental map of it remains.
You're always looking for it.
You are constantly searching the margins of your new chaotic reality, trying to find the structure and safety that used to be there.
That is so powerful.
The artwork doesn't offer you a comfortable, obvious focal point to rest your eyes on, just as displacement offers no comfortable place to rest your head.
So you are forced to endure a tiny fraction of that cognitive load just by trying to look at the painting. The frustration you feel as a viewer is literally the point.
The physical artwork itself becomes a mechanism for empathy. It demands your time and your visual struggle.
And that intensely physical, deeply frustrating, heavily textured object was created in a quiet, isolated studio space in California.
True.
But the physical creation of the piece is only half the story. The causality of what happens next tests the entire thesis of the artwork. Like, can a physical piece made in isolation translate to a hyper-globalized audience?
This brings us to the gallery press release, right?
Yes, detailing the journey this specific piece took in November 2024.
This raises an important question about the role of the environment. Because Homes and Faces III traveled from that solitary California studio to be exhibited at the Andalucía Gallery in Dubai.
The contrast in environments there is just massive. You are moving a piece about displacement and invisible homes into one of the most glittering, hyper-developed, cosmopolitan hubs on the entire planet.
Exhibiting in an international gallery setting like Dubai fundamentally alters the reception of the artwork. Consider the cultural ecosystem of Dubai for a second.
Okay.
It is a massive global crossroads. It's an epicenter of international commerce, transit, and expatriate living.
It's a city where rigid local identities often dissolve into a highly transient cosmopolitan mix.
Exactly.
It's a city largely built by and populated by people from somewhere else. It's a place that is universally connected, which actually mirrors the AI face we talked about at the very beginning.
That's a great connection.
It's an environment that belongs to everyone and therefore lacks a single ancient local anchor.
The parallel to the AI is spot on. Placing this artwork in that specific cultural ecosystem actually completes the conceptual journey of the piece.
How so?
If we connect the digital origin, the physical studio process, and the final gallery destination, we see a deliberate unspooling of identity that happens in three distinct stages of erasure.
Okay, let me see if I can track the pattern here. The first stage of erasure happens inside the computer. The AI neural network strips away the specific geographic and ethnic identity to create the initial borderless face.
That is the first erasure. The second stage happens in the physical studio.
Right, the cubist fragmentation. The artist uses the watercolor and the heavy paper to shatter the architecture, stripping the homes of their recognizable structure and pushing them into the margins.
That's the second erasure.
Which means the third stage of erasure has to be the exhibition itself.
The exhibition in Dubai strips the artwork of its nationality. By moving the piece out of an American studio and placing it in a transient global nexus in the Middle East, it challenges the local audience's cultural interpretations.
Yeah.
It stops a viewer from looking at the painting and saying, you know, oh, this is a painting about an American perspective on a foreign conflict, or this is specifically about a Middle Eastern border crisis.
Exactly. It takes the passport away from the pain. It demands that the international audience recognize displacement and the destruction of the home, not as a regional political issue belonging to one specific group, but as a borderless, universal human condition.
Which perfectly synthesizes the entire debate we started with. The physical act of painting in the California studio, the agonizing wait for the water to dry, the heavy paper resisting the brush, the scabbing mineral pigments, that intense manual labor acts as physical proof of care.
It does.
It prevents the artwork from feeling like a cynical, cheap digital trick. It grounds the concept in human sweat and memory.
The physical friction ensures the empathy is earned, not just generated.
But then, taking that deeply physical object and exhibiting it in a place like Dubai ensures that the empathy doesn't get trapped in one localized narrative. It proves that if you blur the cultural boundaries and take away the zip code, the pain of losing a home is a universal language.
The studio provides the weight, and the global gallery provides the reach.
The tension between its isolated physical creation and its global destination is what forces the viewer to confront the reality of the subject.
It refuses to let you simply categorize the suffering and just walk past it.
So, what does this all mean for us? When we zoom out from the technical specs, the watercolor mechanics, and the gallery locations, what are we really looking at in Homes and Faces 3?
We're looking at a profound statement on survival.
We're looking at a brilliant manipulation of tension. The tension between the heavy, resisting cotton paper and the weightless, placeless AI algorithm. The tension between the contained, silent faces and the violent, scabbing mineral pigments.
It demands that we acknowledge how profound loss reshapes not only our physical structures, but the internal architecture of how we survive day to day.
And for you listening right now, this matters because of the way we consume information today. We live in an era where we scroll past digital images of real tragedy on our phones at a blistering speed.
We do, every single day.
We consume the pain of others as frictionless data. This artwork is a physical roadblock. It is a powerful reminder to stop, to look closely, to endure the frustration of a slow read.
It challenges you to seek out the hidden human elements in an increasingly automated world.
The invisible homes pushed into the margins, it asks you to actually feel the weight of things again.
It uses the tools of the digital age to demand a return to tactile analog empathy.
Which leaves me with a final lingering question for you to ponder long after this deep dive ends. We started by exploring the difference between a weightless algorithm and a heavy physical object.
Right.
If a silent piece of code can successfully map out the universal face of human suffering, and physical crushed stones can make us feel the scabbed weight of that suffering, what happens to our collective memory as our world becomes increasingly virtual?
That's the real question.
In the future, when we need to build monuments to remember the shared traumas that displaced us, will those monuments be carved out of physical stone, or will they be built entirely out of code?
Something to think about.
Keep that in mind the next time you see an image that seems a little too smooth or a tragedy that feels a little too distant. The weight of it is still there, just waiting for someone willing to feel it.